We hope you enjoy this recording of a live broadcast brought to you by Torah in Motion. For more learning opportunities, please visit www.torahinmotion.org.
Good morning, everybody. My brother, Rabbi Jay Kelman, asked me to have the honor to introduce a good friend, Rabbi Natty Helfgott, so it's really a pleasure to do that. As you can see, there's a long list of Rabbi Helfgott's accomplishments. I'll just read off some of them. He is the chair of Tanakh and Jewish Thought Departments and a Magid Shir of Talmud at Yeshiva Chovei Beit Torah in New York. Until this past year, he served as the Judaic Studies Curriculum Coordinator at the Mayanot Yeshiva High School in Teaneck. For 6 years, he was director of the Talmud and Tanakh program at the Drisha Institute in New York. He's taught at Frisch. He's been the educational consultant, the Orthodox Caucus Ethic Project, the Orthodox Forum. He is a graduate of Yeshiva University with a BA with honors in philosophy. He went on to receive a master's degree in Azrieli. He received the smicha at Yeshiva University at the Reed Center. He's a close Talmid, he's studied for a long time with Professor Nachum Leibowitz, who you'll be hearing about later as well, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. He's currently editing two books from Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. He recently published and edited a book of letters, the collected letters of the Rav, of Rav Soloveitchik. Really a tremendous scholar. I mean, again, there's a lot more, but now I'll just for a second extemporaneously tell you that Rabbi Helfgott really is one of the great scholars and teachers, and I think living now, and I'm not saying that as an exaggeration, really is a, I've heard him for many, many years. He has hundreds of students from all around the world who've listened to him, and it really is a pleasure to have Rabbi Helfgott share words. He's a tremendous scholar of Tanakh, a very creative thinker. And you'll hear right from now throughout the day. So it's my pleasure to introduce Rabbi Helfgott.
Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. And thank you, the other Rabbi Kelman. And I also would like to acknowledge Senior Rabbi Kelman, who is... it's really wonderful to be here in Toronto again. It's really special to come. And I wanted to thank the Moreskis for their great hospitality. And it was a wonderful Shabbat, even though it rained and walked here in the rain, but it was really a wonderful Shabbat. And I also want to acknowledge I'm here as the representative of Yeshiva Chovei Torah Rabbinical School, which is co-sponsoring today's event. And Rabbi Jay Kelman is doing amazing work, and everyone should support the work of Torah in Motion in every way, shape they can. For some people that means money, for some people that means support. For some people that means phone calls. For some people that means just giving him a good word of chizuk from time to time, and really wonderful program. This morning I wanted to learn with you a little bit. I hope everybody has a Tanakh, and if you don't, there are more Tanakhim up here. And also a very important announcement, a lot of the good food is in the other room, so if you feel the need to supplement your nourishment, your spiritual nourishment with a brownie in the middle, I won't get offended. And so please don't feel restrained. Okay. No problem. Okay, this morning I wanted to talk with you about the part of the Megillah where we're tired. The part of the Megillah where we're ready to have the bagels and the lox already, i.e. chapter 9, when we're already, Haman is dead, and the anti-Semites are dead, the Jews have basically, as the Tanakh says, have done b'sonehem kirtzonam, they've done to their enemies what they wanted, and it's important to recognize the enemies there means doesn't mean that they just went around killing whoever they wanted. It says b'mavakshei ra'atam, that they killed those who wanted to kill them. It was a preemptive strike, targeted assassinations, whatever term you want to use, to kill those who intended to harm the Jewish people, who were armed and ready to destroy the Jewish communities throughout the Persian Empire. After that's completed. The Tanakh spends an entire chapter telling us about the etiology, not ideology, etiology, with an E-T-I-O-L-O-G-Y, the source, the genesis of the holiday of Purim. And it spends an entire chapter telling us that. And what's interesting is that if you read the chapter carefully, you get the sense that it wasn't so simple to set up the holiday of Purim. There's letters and more letters and more letters and more letters constantly being sent out. And what I'd like to do with you is suggest a couple of readings of this perek of chapter 9 and try to figure out what is driving, what are the issues involved that were at the core of the debate, if we could at least try to tease them out from the text. So if one looks in Perek Tet, which is in these editions, if you have Perek Tet, the ninth chapter, page 892, 893, you can follow in the English or in the Hebrew. So the Tanakh tells us that the Jews fought on the 13th day. The Tanakh tells us in verse 2, Nikalu Yehudim be'areihem b'chol medinot ha-melech ha-chashverosh, lishloach yad b'mevakshei ra'atam, v'ish lo amad lifnehem, ki nafal pach dam al kol ha'amim. Nobody stood before them because the fear of everyone of the Jews came upon them. Just parenthetically, as you read the Megillah this week, take a look and see how many times there's a play on the word nafal and amad. One of the key words throughout the entire Megillah is the literary play of the theme of who will stand and who will fall. Haya'amdu divrei Mordechai, ki nafal pachad hayudim aleihem. V'haman nofel, when Achashverosh comes back, Haman is falling. Zeresh says to Haman, ki nafal tipol. Mordechai doesn't bow down to Haman. And the question is, whose words will stand? One of the key plays in the Megillah is the tension between who will stand and who will fall. Who will sit and who will stand. It's a very interesting thing, but it's not for our. That's a little tidbit that you can examine when you're listening to the Megillah on Monday night. But the text tells us that the Jews destroyed their enemies. In verse 5, Vayakua Yehudim b'choloi vehem makat cherev v'herek v'avdam v'yasub esonehem kirt sonam. And the Jews killed 500 people as well as the sons of Haman. Why does the Bible go out of its way to emphasize the sons of Haman? I mean, we don't like Haman, that's true. But why emphasize the sons of Haman here and list them? And if you've ever read a Megillah, do you ever see the Megillah? It's like in two columns, on one side and on another side. So part of that, I think there are two reasons why the Bible emphasizes it. Number one, remember that Haman, when he came back all happy and giddy that he was going to kill Mordechai, the Bible says that he calls his wife and his friends and he describes everything that had happened to him. Ve'et rov ashro ve'rov banav. How many children he had and how rich he was. So it's very interesting, a kind of v'nahapochu. You have so many kids? Look what happened to your kids. Number one. Number two, the Bible is also here, I think, hinting at something very interesting. The only other place besides the Shirot, besides the songs in the Bible where you have this business of columns, if you know, in Tanakh, is when Joshua captures the cities of Canaan. And you have the listing of the cities of the Melachim of Canaan. Of the kings of Canaan. So there's a kind of, I think, there's a little bit of a statement here that, in effect, the Jews' victory in the diaspora against their enemies has a sort of echo of the conquest of Eretz Yisrael, of the conquest of the land of Israel by Joshua, and the destruction of the kings of Canaan, which, of course, is very fascinating because it means that there's something very powerful here about the self-perception of the Jews in the diaspora, that the experience of Purim, and certainly the writer of the Megillah, is a kind of parallel to the success of the Jews capturing Eretz Yisrael. And now you start to understand a little bit, at least a little bit at first blush, one reason why the rabbis say that what is Purim connected to? Where do they read on the 15th day? On the cities? What's the halakha? The cities that were walled from the time of Yoshua. What does Yoshua have to do with the Megillah? What does Joshua have to do with the Megillah? But there are all kinds of echoes in the Megillah. This is just one of them. That the experience of the Jews, their self-perception of what happened in Persia, was a kind of conquest, a kind of success in battle that had not been seen since the time of Joshua. So there's a kind of interesting echo there as well. And the text continues and tells us that the Jews were very successful. And parenthetically, it says, "Bayomahu," verse 11, "Bayomahu ba mispar harugim b'shushana bira lifnei hamelech." On that day, the number came before the king. Parenthetically, what does the word "shushan habira" mean? Today, convinced, or we are so influenced by modern Hebrew, so we think the word "bira" means capital, which is what Rabbi English translates here. But I don't think that's correct. The word "bira" in ancient Hebrew probably means a fortress of some kind. Like in many ancient cities, there was Shushan HaBira, there was the fortress part of the city, and then there was the where everybody lived in the city. You ever gone like Ir David, and there's a big tower, and then there's the local populace. The same thing, if you look carefully, on the 13th day, the Jews kill 500 people b'Shushan HaBira. But then the next day she comes and she asks, Vatomer, verse 13, Esther, Imala Melech Tov, Yinatem Gam Machal Yudim Asher B'Shushan, La'asot Kedat Hayom. Notice she doesn't say Shushan HaBira. She just says Shushan. There's Shushan HaBira. It's like New York and Metropolitan New York. Or something along those lines. A kind of bad analogy. Or Toronto and Metropolitan Toronto. I don't know if there's, that's the terminology. So, there's Shushan HaBira, which is the local, the fortress, the inner city, where probably the important officials lived. If you've ever been in Tel Aviv, the Kiryah, and then the rest of Tel Aviv, so to speak. And so too here. She goes to she asks for, let's continue in Shushan. And that's what happens the next day. And look, Esther carefully, she uses four terms. I mentioned this yesterday in my talk. Vatomer Esther, Imal HaMelech Tov. Yinatein gam machal yudim asher, I'm sorry, before, that's something else. Asher b'shushan la'asot kedat hayom, v'et aseret b'nei aman yitlu ala eitz, v'yom ha-melech la'asot kein, and there's a battle. And the Jews are successful also in Shushan. U'shar ha-yehudim, asher b'minot ha-melech, verse 16, nikalu v'amol al nafsham v'noach me'oivehem v'arog b'sonehem, chamisha v'shivim aleph, u'babizah lo shalchu et yadam. So the Jews are successful, both in Shushan and outside of Shushan. And the text goes out of its way in verse 17. Biyom shloshar sar l'chodesh Adar, v'noach ba'arba sar v'asa oto yom mishteh v'simcha. Just interesting kind of comment, just a couple of small comments before we get to the big comment. Notice that the Bible, this is the first time in the entire Bible, in the entire Megillah, where the Megillah uses not just the word mishteh, but simcha. There's been a lot of parties in this book, starting with Ahasuerus. Haman and Ahasuerus sit down to drink. There's parties. Esther makes parties. The first time that the term simcha is connected to mishteh is the party of the Jews after they're successful. There's a wonderful statement here. It's not just mishteh. It's not just drinking, but it's mishteh v'simcha. There is a religious dimension, because any reader of the Bible immediately associates simcha with usmachtem lifnei Hashem Elokecha, as it says in Tanakh. Simcha, simcha, simcha. And so there's a wonderful movement here. Also the fact that we make the party on the day that we rested. Why not the day that we were successful, that we were battling them? V'noach me'oivehem. Why not the day that we killed all those anti-Semites? Why not? Why the day that we rested? What do you think? You're allowed to participate. What do you think? Why not the day that we actually killed them? So maybe it's because we want to emphasize. Right, so we wait a day, and then we celebrate their killing.
No. We're celebrating that we're able to stop.
We're celebrating that we're able to stop. A very beautiful thing that we're able to live rather than that we're involved in fighting. That's an interesting idea. What else? Yeah. Right, so maybe even though the Talmud actually says that only applies to Jewish enemies. Okay, we can go back and forth. I'm not sure. I think there's also a literary play here. Remember that when Achashverosh is, when Haman is negotiating with Achashverosh to kill the Jews, he says, "V'la melech ein shoveh le hanicham." It's not worth it to leave them. Now the word lanuach and lahanicham, of course, are not the same word, but there's a play here. That Dafka, the person who wanted lahanicham, not the hanicham, ends up, the Jews end up being Noach. And they're the ones who end up. There's a lot of literary plays in the Megillah, so I think that that's also going on here as well. So the Jews rest. What's interesting is, here you seem to have the first stage. The first stage is spontaneous. Notice carefully. Notice there's no Mordechai and Esther. There's no Sanhedrin. There's no rabbis. There's not even a president of a shul. There's nobody here. It's just the Jews themselves do it. It says that they started to do v'asauto yom mishteh v'simcha. So first stage is a total spontaneous grassroots kind of celebration. It has nothing to do with the rabbinic establishment. It has nothing to do with the synagogue or with the Sanhedrin or anybody else. It's just the Jews do it. V'ayudim asher b'shushan nikalu b'shloshasar bo barbasar bo menoch b'chamishasar v'asauto yom mishteh v'simcha. The first year, there was the Jews throughout the empire, and there were the Jews in Shushan, and everybody did it. If I had a marker, I would write, oh look, there is a marker. Nes Purim. So stage Aleph, is spontaneous. Spontaneous.
Can't see it at all.
Can't see?
Better color?
See a better color. But you can hear me. So if you're an oral learner, that better? Spontaneous. We'll put a big S. Spontaneous. No religious guidance. Yom mishteh v'simcha. Notice there's no mishloach manot. There's no matanot lev yonim. There's nothing. It's just a spontaneous outpouring of joy. Remember, I always think about, remember those grainy films about, Argentina, yes. Russia, yes. And then everybody's all of a sudden dancing the Hora when the state of Israel, da, 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 It's a spontaneous outpouring. It's not like you have a parade on Yom HaTzma'ut and you have to get all the kids to stand in Hatikva. It's just spontaneous. Yes, I'm sorry, you had a question.
So I was just thinking about the parallel between the Shloshasar, Arba Asar, Chamishasar with other Chagim and the Noah. We say the Chamishasar.
Right. Right, but they don't use the word Yom Tov yet. Notice in the spontaneous, there's no religious expression in terms of what we would call ritual. There's no mitzvot. It's not like everybody decides we have to shake a poor, we have to shake a lot, or something like that. There's no religious ritual attached to it. It's a simple, spontaneous act of celebration.
Sorry, I was responding to the Noah.
Oh, the Noah. I understand, right. Okay. Number two, the second stage. The Tanakh continues, Al kein haYehudim haPirazim haYoshvim biarei haPirazot osim et yom arbasa lechodesh adar simcha umishtevi yom tov umishloch manot ish l'reihu. This already, many people read it as if it's all one big thing, but this is a second stage. This is talking about as years went on. Al kein reminds us of, remember in Sefer Bereshit, after Jacob emerges from his conflict with the nocturnal angel or Ish. And it says, he goes out limping. So then it says, Al-Kain Ayuhudim, doesn't say Ayuhudim, Al-Kain Lo Yochlu B'nei Israel. Therefore, from then on, the Jews don't eat the Gid HaNasheh, the sciatic nerve. Meaning, Al-Kain is a language of the future. This is the practice. So the text tells us, as time went on, a custom developed. Still notice there's no Mordechai, there's no Esther, there's no Sanhedrin, there's no Anshe Knesset HaGdolah, there's nobody. It says the Jews, Al kein haYehudim haPirazim haYoshvim yarei haPirazot osim et yom arbasa lechodesh adar
Simcha u'mishteh, v'yom tov, u'mishloch manot ish l'reihu. I would like to point out two things. First of all, notice the change, the shift. In the stage one, it's mishteh v'simcha. What's it here? Besides that, but also? Simcha u'mishteh. Notice the subtle shift in terms of order. The emphasis has moved from mishteh v'simcha to simcha u'mishteh. The religious element is starting to creep in, even on the grassroots level. The sense that it is not just a party, but it's simcha which expresses itself in mishteh. It's an interesting little shift. Number one. Number two, as was pointed out, the Yom Tov, which seems to mean that they wanted to give it the full force of a holiday. And Mishloch Manot Ishlorehu. There's one place in Tanakh in which Mishloch Manot are mentioned. That's in the book of Nehemiah, chapter 8, where Nehemiah describes Rosh Hashanah. And the people are crying on Rosh Hashanah. And he says, don't cry, today's a holiday. And it's a day that you should go home and prepare meals and send Mishloch Manot to those who don't have. That's what it says in Nehemiah. So the echo here is an echo of trying to establish a real, full-fledged, biblical model holiday of the Second Temple, the Book of Nehemiah. They're trying to do something which is very concrete, something that has ritual to it. But what's interesting is, it only says, HaYehudim HaPrazim. This is grassroots. This is also grassroots. We'll just put grass. Grassroots. But it's grassroots with an attempt to establish a custom. And it's happening. Alkeina Yehudim HaPrazim HaYoshvim Yarei HaPrazot. Jews start to do this as normal. What's interesting is, we have a very specific term. Arei HaPrazot. The cities which are the Arei HaPrazot. Notice before, in stage 1, we did not have that phrase. In stage 1, in verse 16, all it says is Ushar haYehudim asher b'medinot haMelech. All of a sudden, the Jews who are in the stage one called Sha'ar haYehudim, which I don't see as such a great term. The rest, there's New York and the rest of the country. There's Toronto and the rest of Canada. Let's think about it. That's what Sha'ar haYehudim. There's Shushan. I don't think that's such a great term. I don't think I would or you would want to be called that. But all of a sudden, they move to a new term. If you look, Arei HaPrazot. Very striking. Think about where that term, think about it in your head. Let it percolate a little bit. What is the significance of that term, Arei HaPrazot? And the text continues. Also, in this second stage, notice that there's no mention of Shushan, and there's no mention of any of the other walled cities. It just mentions the unwalled cities. It doesn't mention the walled cities. So there's a little bit of a shift. In the spontaneous stage, everybody seems to be involved. The Jews all over the diaspora are involved on the 14th day having a holiday. The Jews in Shushan are involved on the 15th day of the holiday. On the second stage, all of a sudden, the Jews of Shushan kind of disappear. And the only ones who are mentioned are the Jews in the walled, are in the unwalled cities. Very interesting. Stage 3. I'm going to come back to that. For the first time, Mordechai and Esther get involved. But it's interesting, not Esther, Mordechai. Vayichtov Mordechai et advarim ha'ele vayishlach svarim el kol ha'yudim asher b'chol medinot ha'melech ha'chashverosh ha'kerovim v'harechokim. L'kayim aleihem liyot osim et yom arba'asar l'chodesh adar v'et yom chamishasar bo b'chol shana v'shana. All of a sudden we have the rabbinic establishment decides that it has to get involved. Something isn't working. Something isn't working. Something is missing. Not all the Jews seem to be involved in the process. Very, very interesting. So there's stage 3. So I'd like to analyze what's happening in stage 3. Vayichtov Mordechai. And I'd like to offer two readings of the story. One which is based on the Ramban, Nachmanides. in his commentary on Masechet Megillah, and one which is based on an alternate reading, which is based on a close reading, which some people have developed. And, you know, you can choose which one speaks more to you. The Ramban, Nachmanides, he reads, he starts actually from a kind of meta question. The meta question that he asks is, why is it that, as opposed to all other Jewish practices where we like unity, everybody should do the same thing. We don't like this person does this thing and that person does that thing. Here, all of a sudden, we glory in diversity. If you're from this city, you should do it on this day. If you're on this day, you should have unity. Why didn't they just decide at one time to do all, everybody should do either the 14th or the 15th or both? What is this business? You're this, what is this? Sfarad, Ashkenaz, what are you doing here? So the Ramban says, because the genesis of the holiday, if you look carefully, was very, very tenuous. His reading is as follows. He suggests that there's a gap between stage one and stage two already. And he claims, if you read the text carefully, what really happened is that only the Jews in the unwalled cities continued the custom of Purim. That's how he emphasizes that there's no mention of Shushan. For him, Shushan becomes a model for what later in Jewish halacha becomes all the walled cities. And the Ramban says, as time went on, only the Jews in the periphery continued to keep the holiday of Purim. The Jews in the walled cities started to forget Purim. They became very comfortable because they felt we were protected. We lived in the good neighborhood. Nothing would have happened to us anyway. We had connections. That's the way the Ramban talks. Ramban says, the Jews of the walled cities did not continue the spontaneous practice of Purim. Only the Jews in the Areya Prazot, only the Jews in the periphery, in the unwalled cities, the folk Jews, the Jews in the villages who felt really threatened, who didn't have political connections, who didn't have arms, those are the Jews who continued to do Purim. But these Jews were okay. And says the Ramban, Nachmanides, what happened in stage three is that Mordechai, look carefully at the text, gives them a Musar lesson, if we wanted to use modern yeshivish colloquialism. Mordechai, look carefully at what he writes. Vayichtov, verse 20. Vayichtov Mordechai et advarim ha'elav, vayishlach svarim el kol ha'yehudim. Notice the emphasis on the word kol. To all the Jews. Asher bechol medinot ha'melech. To all the Jews everywhere. Ha'kerovim v'harechokim. Those who are close and far. Every Jew. He reintroduces into the conversation the concept of the 15th day, which had been absent in the second stage. In the second stage, it only mentions the 14th day. Verse 19. No mention of the 15th. It sloughed off. It disappeared, says Ramban. And Mordechai, notice carefully, introduces the 15th day again. And look what he says in verse 24. Ki Haman ben Hamidata ha'agagi tzorer kol ha'yehudim. This is the only place in the Tanakh, in the Megillah, where it's not just tzorer ha'yehudim, but tzorer kol ha'yehudim. The Ramban makes a very big deal about Mordechai is emphasizing Sorer Kol HaYehudim, all the Jews were threatened. Don't think that because you live in Park Avenue or whatever the equivalent is, what's the equivalent here?
Forest Hill.
Okay. Don't think because you live in Forest Hill, you're okay. Sorer Kol HaYehudim, he would have gotten to all of you guys. That's what Mordechai has to emphasize. Throughout the Megillah, Haman, when he's called Sorer, he's called Sorer HaYehudim. But says Ramban, here he's called Sorer Kol HaYehudim, because he was trying to teach them something. So according to the Ramban, that's the move from stage 2 to stage 3. A very interesting, nice reading. Yes? The Ramban is in Masechet Megillah, in the Chidushim, in the very beginning of the Ramban. And it's discussed in the Ran. It's discussed in the Ran at the beginning of Masechet Megillah. In fact, I can read to you one or two lines just outside, if I can find it quickly. The Ramban, Nachmanides, the great 13th century Sephardi rabbi. He starts his thing. He says, "Ani tamei ma ra'u al kacha umahigi alehem laso Israel agudot agudot b'mitzvazu." He says, "I don't know why are Jews splitting up. Some Jews do this and some Jews do that, and some Jews try to do both. If you're in yeshiva in Israel, you try to get drunk twice. And what is this business? The Torah says Torah achat u'mishpat echad yelachem. You're supposed to have one Judaism, not bifurcated Judaism." So he says, "Ukeshiyanti baktuvim nityashev li ha'inyan yafeh." He says, "When I looked carefully and I studied Tanakh," very interesting Ramban, he says, "I figured out what's going on here." And he says, what happened here, let me read to you. "Aval mukafim," as time went on, "lo asu klum." I'm sorry, "kshas naseh hanes," when the miracle happened that first year, "asu kulam yom noach umishteh v'simcha." Everybody did it. But as time went on, "v'zeh haya b'shnat hanes bilvad," this was in the year of the miracle alone. "ולאחר מכן בשנים הבאות עמדו פרזים ונהוג מעצמם לעשות יום ארבע עשרה שמחה ומשתה ויום טוב." Then the Jews in the area prazot, they continued. "אבל מוקפים לא עשו כלום." But the מוקפים, they didn't do anything. They thought they weren't in danger. But afterwards, God enlightened them. And Mordechai taught them, no. That's not true. They shouldn't think that. Don't think, he says, "Klomar shalach lahem shi kablu kulam lasot zechel anes." Mordechai sent them that everybody should continue to do it. "V'lo yomru harechokim mishushan lo haya haman ba'im eilenu v'kiblu Yisrael lehem adavar." And that's exactly, that says, "V'natan tam," that's why he gave a reason, "ki haman ben hamnata tzorer kol ha'yehudim hosif bikan milat kol shehaya hanes likulam." That the miracle was on. A very fascinating Ramban, where he kind of leaves his halachic hat and does parshanut in his commentary on the Shas, on the Talmud. This is the reading of the Ramban. But there's another way to read this, which is, again, the Ramban has a lot of problems in it because he makes other assumptions, which I'm not getting involved in, but you can read it for yourself and you can analyze it yourself. There's a second way to read this. And the second way to read it, which gets back to what I talked about before, and you can find, some people have discussed this, one of my teachers, Rav Yoel Ben Nun, has discussed this, and others have discussed this, that this is a different, that there's something else going on here. Not the question of the threat, but the question of the authority. What do I mean? The first point is, notice that in the original terminology, the Jews outside of Shushan, meaning if you read the Megillah Kipshuta, there is no statement that distinguishes between the walled cities and the unwalled cities. If you read the Megillah carefully, what's the distinction really about? Look carefully at that first year. What's the distinction between what cities and which cities? Walled cities and unwalled cities, or what cities? Shushan and everybody else. If you really read it Kifshuto, there's no mention here of a distinction between walled cities and unwalled cities. And even when we introduce the phrase Arei HaPrazot, the phrase Arei HaPrazot is not contrasted with Arei Mukafot Choma, with cities that are, it's just not in the text. This is a rabbinic layering later. But in the Pshat, it doesn't mention that. So what's the Pshuto Shel Mikra, the simple, plain sense of the text? So Rav Yoel suggests, look carefully at this move from Sha'ara Yehudim, to Arei HaPrazot. What's going on? The issue here is basically, as time went on, the Jews of Shushan, in effect, wanted that their holiday, the idea of doing it on the 14th and the 15th, because they fought on the 13th or the 14th, or so either the 14th and the 15th or just the 15th, should be the one that should be the standard for the whole of the Jewish diaspora and the Jewish people. Diaspora as well as in Eretz Yisrael. Shushan said, we are the center of Jewish life. We are the center of Jewish life, and everyone should follow us. Everyone is Sha'ar HaYehudim. Everyone else are the, you know, the Nebuchs who live outside. You have to follow our... We are now the center of Jewish life. We are Babylon. We are Bavel, Eretz Yisrael, and all the other centers. Remember, according to Pshuto Shel Mikra, the Megillah does not happen between the two Batei Mikdash. It happens already maybe 50, 60 years after the rebuilding of the Second Temple, where most Jews are living in the diaspora, not in Eretz Yisrael. Most Jews are still living... Most Jews didn't make Aliyah from the West, from Babylon. They didn't make Aliyah, right? The East there. That was the East, today it's the West, right? So most Jews were very, very comfortable in Persia. And now they say, we are the center. It's it. And what in fact happens is that as time goes on and there starts to be a question of establishing a holiday, the Jews outside of Shushan start to assert their own authority. They're not going to be called anymore Sha'ar HaYehudim. We're Arei HaPrazot. We have our own identity. And in fact, Rav Yoel points to the fact, where else in Tanakh is the term Arei HaPrazot actually used? Anybody remember? Shoftim, but even before that, in the book of Dvarim, in the book of Deuteronomy, in the book of Joshua, and in the book of Shoftim. You know when it's... Every other time in Tanakh when the term Arei HaPrazot is used, it's referring to Eretz Yisrael. It's referring to the cities in the land of Israel. It's not referring to some city in the middle of China. It's referring to the cities. Take a look in Dvarim, Perek Vav, and in Yoshua, all over the place. The term Arei HaPrazot, up until this point in the Tanakh, has always referred to the cities in Eretz Yisrael, when that term has been used. And so Rav Yoel argues what really is going on here is that the Jews in Israel are saying, you Shushan, you don't have the right to assert to hegemony, to decide what will be the future of Jewish practice. Eretz Yisrael is still the center. Boy, that sounds a lot of familiar. Who's in charge? Is this new reality of diaspora existence and the fact that Shushan is the center of Jewish culture and experience and Mordechai and Esther are in power, does that now mean that they usurp the rest of the Jewish diaspora, including Eretz Yisrael, which is still a center? There's Nehemiah and there's Ezra and there's still Jews living there. And that's the issue. And claims, Rabbi Yoel, what happens in the third stage? Notice carefully. Again, we are so conditioned to read it through rabbinic eyes. Let's put that in the... Check that for a second. Read the text carefully. What's Mordechai actually asking the Jews to do? Vayichtov Mordechai et hadvarim ha'ele. Vayishlach svarim el kol ha'yudim asher b'chol medinot ha'melech ha'chashveyosh ha'kovim. L'kayem aleihem liyot osim et yom arba'asar l'chodesh adar v'et yom chamishasar bo b'chol shana v'shana. If I woke you up 3 o'clock in the morning, what is Mordechai asking them to do throughout the empire? What's he actually asking them to do? That everybody should do 2 days. There's no mention here of, and some Jews will do it on the 14th, and some Jews will do it on the 15th. The simple pshat is Mordechai, in effect, wants to kind of do a grand compromise. Everyone should do 2 days. Let everyone do 2 days. So we'll assert the authority of Shushan, but we'll also assert your authority and everybody. What's interesting is that while temporarily it seems to work, it doesn't really work because there's a fourth stage. Look at verse 29. In verse 29, and that's one of the reasons why this book is not called Megillat Mordechai, it's called Megillat Esther. There are many other reasons, but here's another one. Finally, for this to work, Esther has to get involved. And the text says, Vatichtov Esther Hamalka Bat Avichail Umordechai HaYehudi Et Kol Tokef Lekayem Et Igeret HaPurim Hazot HaShenit Vayishlach Svarim El Kol HaYehudim El Sheva Ve'esrim Ve'yam Dina Machut HaChashrosh Divrei Shalom Ve'emet. Why Divrei Shalom Ve'emet? What's that phrase Divrei Shalom Ve'emet mean? Words of peace and truth. This is called reconciliation. Words of peace. There's conflict. Not everyone is comfortable with Mordechai's compromise. Not everyone is comfortable. And she has to convince them with Divrei Shalom Ve'emet. The Pshuto Shamikra, words of peace and truth. She has to get involved with the full force of the Persian Empire. Vayishlach Sfarim Divrei Shalom Ve'emet. Lekayem et Yimei HaPurim Ha'ele Bizmanehem Kasher Kiyem Alehem Mordechai Yehudi Ve'Ester HaMalkah. And it's interesting, she uses for the first time the term bizmanehem, in their times. In their times. If you ask me, it's in this fourth stage where Esther gets involved that the way that we celebrate Purim comes to the fore. Bizmanehem, I think, is a reference to each community in its own time. And the, in effect, assertion that just because Shushan has become a center of Jewish life, and just because Shushan has become a center of Jewish power, that doesn't negate the fact that the Arei HaPrazot, Eretz Yisrael, continues to play a critical role. And this also explains this whole business of, once again, why are we connected to Joshua? Why are the walled cities connected to Joshua? What does Joshua have to do with the Megillah? Ma inyan Shmita Eitzel Har Sinai. Ma inyan Yehoshua Eitzel HaMegillah. What do they have to do with each other? But if the Arei HaPrazot were asserting the significance of Eretz Yisrael, and therefore this is the issue, then this becomes part of the Cheshbon. This is another reading of the story, of the development of Purim. That different things, that there was a challenge here. There was a tension here between the Arei HaPrazot, who had been called Shara Yudim, and the Jews of Shushan. And it's only through the intervention of Mordechai and Esther that this is worked out, and this ultimately finds its resolution. So this is what I wanted to share with you this morning. I think, you know, it's a very, you know, striking situation here in Perek Tet. We sometimes read it very quickly, but it really gets to the heart, and it really is very interesting to me because it also reflects a different kind of holiday than we're used to. This, instead of a top-down model, Purim represents a model of a grassroots holiday that eventually becomes codified and ritualized in Jewish life. And I think that some of the merriment and some of the letting go that the halakha allows for on Purim is rooted in the fact that it started as a grassroots holiday. It didn't start from the rabbinic establishment, it started from the people. And so some of the letting go is a reflection of that. And the fact that it started as a minhag has tremendous ramifications on all kinds of things that go on Purim. And so this is, I think, very inherent in the text of chapter 9. So we have a few minutes for questions, right? We have a little bit of time for questions or comments if people would like to share. I certainly be open to any comments or additions that people would like to ask questions. Please. My voice is going, so... No comments. Everyone is accepted. I need some of those people from Mizrahi Bayit. Shalom.
No, all my questions have been answered.
Oh, really? That's a new one. Oh, my goodness.
I'm tired from last night.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Could there be a parallel between the fact that they celebrated on the day that they rested, as opposed, in connection with the story of Hanukkah, for example, where they also, the holiday also occurs after the battle?
Not really. If you look at the text of the Megillat Ta'anit, it says, Ukeshegavru Malchut Chashmonai, it was on the 25th day. It sounds like that's the day that they won, and then they went into the Beit HaMikdash. It's not the day that they rested. On Hanukkah, it's actually the actual day that they declared victory when they were, again. So you could quibble, you could say that means the day after. I don't know. But I don't think so. I don't think that, necessarily, we celebrate the seventh day of Pesach as the day that the, Kriyat Yam Suf. We don't celebrate the day after Kriyat Yam Suf. We celebrate the day that the Egyptians were drowned. Now, we're not celebrating the drowning, but it goes hand in hand together. The salvation and the drowning happened on the same day. The same thing. The Jews were saved, and they were saved, and they killed, on the same day. And yet I'm sorry. Eretz Yisrael, that's the reading, right.
Now, why would the Megillah, according to that approach, be hidden about referring to Eretz Yisrael as Eretz Yisrael and use this term of rape presence, seeing that most readers won't necessarily know that it's the first?
So that's a good question. It may reflect a certain self-censorship in order to be careful with the Persian authorities. It may also show that the bias of the author of the Megillah, who wants to really wants Shushan to be the center, but he's got to recognize that that's not what happened in the history, but from his perspective, that's what should have happened. And that really, the Arei Prazot were making trouble. And I think maybe that's it, because this book doesn't really focus on Eretz Yisrael. It's really about the experience of the Jews and how you succeed in the land, in the diaspora, and how you're able to work out Jewish history even when you're not living in the central land. So maybe. But it's a good question. It would be nicer. Yes.
According to the Ramban,
right.
Mordechai's point was to say, you Jews were acting differently. Really, we were all living together.
That's right. So why not make one?
Yeah, then how does that answer his question?
So I think the Ramban says no. By emphasizing the diversity of practice, you basically teach everybody, it's paradoxical, you teach everybody to think about the fact that, it's not just these guys who were in trouble, but you were in trouble. You have to think about your own experience and not just say, because I'm part of the Jewish people, so I'm celebrating. Oh, yeah, because some guy in Russia is in trouble, I got to say Tillim, but I'm very comfortable here. No, you yourself experienced a threat. That was a real threat that you should always remember as a real threat. That's what I think the Ramban is driving at. Yes. Yes.
In the historical context, the Jews were saved many times throughout history. Why do you think this particular salvation celebrated by the Jews?
It's a very good question. I think that they were still, they were on the cusp of, they still saw themselves as tied to biblical history, if we want to use that term. This is very early, right on the cusp of when the Tanakh stopped being written, when Nivu'ah, as we know it, stopped being given, and they saw it as part of kind of the close of an era. They also saw this as the kind of paradigm for the future. It's a good question. I don't know, have an answer, but many of those other salvations happened post the authority to create a new biblical model, a new biblical book, and therefore they had problems doing what they, they, but it's a very good question. Right. Right. Well, it's clear from the end that we read that Esther in effect pushes through the holiday with the authority of her role as queen. Vatichtov Esther Hamalka et Kol Tokef. To get it really happening, she had to bring the whole weight
of the authority of the Persian Empire to convince all these Jews to, you know, get their house in order and let's, you know, stop this bickering and let's do it. So maybe that's what made it stick in a way. And, you know, maybe the only reason that Hanukkah ultimately was able to, you know, be successful because it was in about Eretz Yisrael and it was about other things. And, you know, and there are other things to say about Hanukkah, but not for now. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
By the way, we have a few copies left of Rabbi Helfgott's book on the Rav. You know, he collected many of the letters of the Rav. This is an absolutely fascinating book on letters and communications of the Rav. So there are a few available for sale, not too many. And then we have, of course, the other books that are both hot off the press by Rabbi Berman, who will be speaking across the hall on economic downturn, biblical remedies. I don't know if he's giving any practical advice, but across the hall. And Rebecca Wint and Yael Unterman on the Chamlibuts. This came out maybe a month ago, this book. They're both available here for sale for less than you can buy it in the bookstores. I don't even know if they're available yet in the bookstores. And in this room, the talk by Rebecca Winter on repetitive stories in Tanakh, on seeing double. So we'll take a 3-minute break, refreshments in the other room, and reconvene at your convenience. Thank you. And thank you to Rabbi Helfgott.
We hope you found this recording a most enjoyable learning experience. We welcome your feedback. Please contact us at info@torahinmotion.org or at www.torahinmotion.org. Have a great day. Thank you.